You're listening to the Bigfoot Information Project podcast, episode number 4, Sasquatch on the Oklahoma Prairie. I first met Elton Higgins at the International Bigfoot Symposium at Willow Creek, California in 2003. I know that sounds like the kind of place that all the high-level Bigfoot muckety-mucks would get together and network and stuff, but actually I just bumped into him at the parking lot of the Bigfoot Motel. His presentation at the symposium that year was on the evaluation of Bigfoot photographs and was, I thought, pretty insightful. So much so that when I started the Bigfoot Information Project, I asked Elton to contribute an article based on his presentation, and you can find that article on our website at bigfootproject.org. Elton spends his time now as a field researcher and investigator for the Texas Bigfoot Research Conservancy. He's been involved in Bigfoot research since the late 90s, first with the BFRO and now with the TBRC. His day job is as a professor at Mid-America Christian University in Oklahoma City. He holds degrees in zoology and wildlife biology and has experience as a field biologist in Arizona. He and the TBRC have invited me down to Texas to observe their work on an ongoing research project. Elton and I meet up in Oklahoma City and are driving down to the Big Thicket area of southeast Texas to rendezvous with a team of TBRC researchers there. But that story's for another Bibcast. Right now, he and I are taking a little detour to the site of a remarkable series of events that started in a highly unlikely setting. What followed was a multi-year investigation into Sasquatch sightings in rural Oklahoma that yielded several credible encounter reports. A healthy crop of physical evidence, some of which found its way into his Willow Creek presentation, and an up-close, yet brief encounter with a large hairy biped. Our destination this rainy morning is a small Indian casino sitting on a little hill in the middle of the prairie. While the windshield wipers keep a steady rhythm, I ask Elton to tell me how this fascinating story began.
The first clue that we had that anything was going on was we had a report submitted to the BFRO. It was a very brief little report. I think it was the one that mentioned the casino surveillance footage. Ended up having a number of reports submitted that actually described that or talked about it. Not that all of them had seen it, but a lot of people had heard about it.
So several members of the tribe had submitted the rumor or the tale of this video, not just this initial one. So you actually had this submitted to you several times.
Oh yeah, yeah. Over the months, quite a few people had heard about it and submitted reports, half a dozen or so perhaps, something like that. At any rate, the person that submitted this particular report had a very unusual last name, and it was immediately identified as a hoax report, but I wasn't sure. I mean, it was from Oklahoma, so, you know, that was the state I lived in, obviously, and so I was interested in it, and so I looked up the last name in the phone book, and there it was. A lot of the members of this tribe have what we would consider very unusual last names, and this was a pretty strange last name. So anyway, I told Matt that I thought it was probably legit, and I was going to try and check it out.
That's Matt Moneymaker of the BFRO.
Right, right, yeah.
Were you the first person to investigate this, or was there anybody else who came out to check it out before you did?
No, I was not the first person. I was the first person to make a call on it. We received a report from a non-tribal member. This was, I'm trying to remember if she reported the casino footage or if she had a sighting. I think there was a woman that somehow heard about all of this, and she thought we needed to know about it. And so I tried to call her up and wasn't able to make contact with her. So we had another guy here in Oklahoma who was real gung-ho. I'd reported that I tried to make contact and wasn't able to, and he was wanting to check it out. So I told him, well, if you want to, you know, try and get a hold of her, okay, and if you make any plans, you know, make sure you let me know.
Is the area that the casino's in, is it known for activity, or have you had reports from that area previously?
It turns out that there have been sightings from this area going back, I guess, quite a few years. So this wasn't the first. And as I checked it out and talked with different individuals, it turns out that there have been sightings going way back, I guess, you know, for decades.
Unfortunately, at this part of our story, the exuberance of a youthful investigator nearly derailed the entire investigation. Without getting into the gory details, let's just say something terrible happened. Somebody told the media.
Well, the response to the news crew showing up was immediate and decisive, shall we say. From what I've been told, the reporter that was with the cameraman, the team, I don't know how many people went out there, But I guess they were pretty pushy. And again, this is just from what I've been told, but they showed up at the casino, announced, "We've heard that you guys have footage of a Bigfoot, and we're here to do a story on that." You know, something like that. And the tribal response was to basically kick them out. The casino security people, I guess, didn't take kindly to it. And they showed them the door and said, "We're not going to cooperate with any kind of a story about a Bigfoot." And booted the television crew out. And then they told their employees, anyone that says the word Bigfoot or Sasquatch is going to be fired. I mean, they wanted nothing to do with it.
At that point, what was their relation with the investigator on the scene and with you, if they had a relationship with you at that point?
Well, we have a guy in Tulsa named Roger Roberts. He's a private investigator, and he works, does a lot of work for different agencies up there. Very, very capable guy. Roger came down and was able to, I think he was able to kind of calm some nerves.
So Roger comes in and sort of calms him down following the media's involvement. Does the media run a story on this at that point? Does it get out, or did it just sort of like fizzle out?
No, I don't recall there being any story about it. I don't think there was. Television crews went out there on other occasions, and whenever they'd meet up with Keith, the guy that I mentioned earlier that sent in this report, because he would be mentioned. You know, they'd say, you know, you got to get with Keith. He's the guy that knows all about this. At the time, Keith was basically in charge of anything that had to do with wildlife on tribal land. Keith was kind of the guy that dealt with all that kind of stuff. So it kind of fell to him to, address these things. Whenever one of these news crews would go out to the area, they'd look up Keith. They'd say something like, you know, "Hey, we were told that you're the guy to contact about Bigfoot out here. What can you tell us? You know, is there a Bigfoot out here?" And Keith would usually say something like, "Oh, yeah, yeah." They'd get all excited, you know. And he'd say, "Yeah, I saw him just like recently. He was with the Easter Bunny." And they'd, you know, you can imagine how they'd kind of get deflated.
Back in the van and drive back to the station.
He'd say, "Guys, there's nothing out here." He said, "I'm out here all the time." You know, he basically would just lie to them and just get rid of them that way.
What did the BFRO propose to do with this video? What if anything, was done with this video following the initial contact?
Well, we wanted to know that it existed in the first place. I mean, we had all these people telling us. You know, I don't know how many people I've talked to that said they saw it or had like a son or a cousin or a brother or something like this that saw it. I never saw it. Roger went in, struck up a relationship with this Lance guy. Roger and Gary, another guy from Tulsa that did a lot of volunteer work, they saw it, but, you know, I never saw it. Security people, and that was kind of just on the, you know, QT, so to speak. The tribe said that they didn't want anybody to see it, and I think this Lance dude maybe copied it off, and I'm not sure exactly how their security system worked, but I think it was a setup where it just kind of went over, you know, a long tape or something. And so Lance somehow put it off to the side. I'm not sure exactly how he secured it. But the problem is Lance, not too long after all this happened, got a different job up in Canada. And so, you know, we lost contact with him. And all of our... When he left, you know, we had no further access to it, and basically lost our inside guy.
Okay, so Lance was really working with you guys. The tribe at that point, was the tribe interested in working with the BFRO or any of the investigators?
We never went to the tribal council or the business committee, or, you know, any of the people that actually run things. We were pretty much interested in trying to get evidence, and we were working through Keith. You know, Keith gave me a permit. Keith wrote out a permit that gave me permission to go on to the tribal land and stay for prolonged periods of time and what have you. And we were working with Keith. He was out there all the time. From our perspective, he was, you know, an authority figure that, you know, that we could work with to deal with this, you know, wildlife-related situation.
was Lance left. He presumably left the video there since no one has any contact with the tribe. Would Keith have been helpful in trying to see the video again or not?
We were told it was destroyed.
How did it end with Keith? What further investigation was done on the tribe's land?
Well, we were just beginning with Keith. Keith didn't have any say as far as the casino was concerned. You know, that was strictly the security people there, and, you know, they didn't want anything to do with the subject at all. I don't know if they were concerned about getting the wrong kind of publicity or attracting the wrong kinds of people. You know, the tribe is, you know, they want people to go there and spend money in the casino, but they're not interested in people running around their land and bugging their people or anything like that. So it was kind of a touchy situation.
It's too bad they could have had, like, the Bigfoot casino. You could imagine a big animated neon Bigfoot over the thing, sort of, come on in. I don't know, could have been a big draw.
I don't know. They weren't interested in it, is all I can tell you. The Sasquatch that walked up to the casino, the parking lot behind the building where the grease trap was, it bordered a field, and the field had just recently been plowed and disked, was smooth as anything. And when we get there, you'll see the land is just perfect for leaving tracks. You know, it's extremely fine soil. And when it's damp, especially, it's like a real fine, powdery, sugary sand. And birds walking leave tracks in this soil when the conditions are right. And so it wasn't just this video image. There were tracks left in this field as the Sasquatch walked up to the grease trap. And so word of these tracks had spread far and wide too. And when I got out there, you know, like I said, Matt had called me and said, please get out there. So I drove out there, and there were still people there. And I talked with an older lady. It looked like she was in her 60s or 70s perhaps. And I just struck up a conversation with her, and she said there were vehicles there from out of state. She said there were government vehicles there. She didn't know what agency they were from. She said they had these big official-looking, logos and on their vehicle doors, and she said they were from out of state. She didn't say what state, but it attracted a lot of attention. And when I went out, there was a few days after all of this, but I could still see some of the tracks. They'd been cast, and there was a lot of junk left over from the cast. And so what I saw of the tracks was just, you know, vague imprints.
How much time had elapsed between the recording of the figure and the time that the initial investigator arrived and then when you got on the scene, do you think?
I'm not sure. It was probably a couple of days or so. Driving right now, there have been Sasquatch sightings from where we're driving right now, even though it looks totally open.
Well, I'll describe where we are. I mean, we're driving through farmland, and there's occasional trees, but I wouldn't call any of this stuff woods. It's individual trees, windbreaks, that sort of thing. But there have been sightings in this area.
Well, we just crossed the river. It's one of the major rivers that goes across Oklahoma, so we're very close to it. There's little wood plots around, but you're right. I mean, this is one of the biggest things that concerned me. When I came out here, I thought, there can't possibly be a Sasquatch out here. I mean, this is just not appropriate habitat at all.
The encounters, the sightings that are reported from out here, I assume they're all at night?
Most are at night, but there are some significant sightings that were from the daytime. The one that I just mentioned, I said there was a sighting from here. It was like early morning, like 5 in the morning or so, barely enough light to see. And it was a guy that saw one walking apparently from the river across this field here up towards the casino.
And with that, we arrive. If when you hear the word casino, you're thinking of the giant neon beasts found in Las Vegas, think again. Like many casinos located on small or rural reservations, this one is about the same size and shape of a large high school gymnasium. There are open fields all around, and it's bordered on two sides by busy country roads. As we walk across the parking lot, Towards the back of the structure, I see several sheds and outbuildings along the blacktop's edge. Beyond those, a barbed wire fence. Beyond that, open pasture, dotted with the occasional grouping of trees. I'll admit that when I think of Sasquatch, this kind of location is hardly the first to pop into my mind. Alton takes me to the spot where a large, dark figure was recorded on videotape. I see a grease trap, which is a kind of metal container about the size of a small dumpster, where the kitchen brings whatever's left over after a day's French fries and onion rings are made. Next to the trap is a light on a pole, and I'm told the bottom of that light was measured to be 9 feet high. Alton walks me through the scene as it appeared when he arrived and shows me where he saw the purported trackway left by the figure shown in the video. Looking back, I can see a single security camera directly across the lot from the grease trap, high up on the back of the casino building. We walk down to the corner of the fence behind where the video is captured, and Alton describes the vector he believes the subject took before being recorded. Across the street from where the corner of the pasture meets the parking lot, there is a shallow ravine that heads into undeveloped tribal land, some of which is used for sacred ceremonies. Alton found an impression in the grass under a tree that stood on the corner of the pasture back then, which suggests something large sat there for a period of time, presumably coming up from the ravine. Leading from the impression is a trackway that eventually crosses the fence and goes up to the scene of the video. There are a few lights in the casino parking lot, and one obviously just above the grease trap, but the fence is out of their range, and there's nothing else that would have illuminated a large dark figure as it walked along there at night. In the direction the figure was seen walking in the video was a line of trees and more pasture. A couple of miles beyond that is a river that flows through the area. We leave the casino to tour the surrounding countryside, and Alton shows me the locations of several encounter reports he investigated in the years following the video event. The village near the casino, it's really too small to call a town, is an assembly of modest, older homes dotted in and amongst the trees on narrow country roads. Despite the casino operating just a few miles away and in sharp contrast to some reservations associated with larger, busier, and more conveniently located casinos, this does not appear to be a very affluent community. Certainly not destitute or squalid, but very modest. It occurs to me again that if the casino or the tribe wanted to exploit what the security camera recorded that night, they very easily could have, and in fact, this place looked like it could use the money. We leave the village area and drive back into town to meet Roger Roberts, the investigator who worked directly with those who are cooperative at the casino. Roger has seen the video, and I'm very anxious to hear his impressions of it. My impression of Roger when we meet at a coffee shop just off the interstate is that he's a no-nonsense, level-headed fellow. With his close-cropped gray hair, crisp white dress shirt, and snazzy tie, I can see both the private investigator he is now and the Army Ranger who served 2 tours in Vietnam he used to be. Moments after shaking his hand and sitting down to order lunch, it seems clear to me that Roger's not likely to suffer from irrational exuberance or excessive enthusiasm. As our efficient waitress delivers our lunch and refills our drinks, and with at least one other table listening in to at least part of our conversation, Roger begins to tell his part of the story.
Roger, from what I understand, you were one of the first people to investigate the video that was taken by the surveillance camera at the casino. Is that true?
That's true. I think we were the first people to see it outside casino security.
Besides the casino staff, how many investigators would you say have seen this video?
David Wilbanks was a volunteer investigator at the time, and a friend of mine, Gary Helberg, who is not affiliated with the BFRO or at that time, he also saw the video.
Okay, so that's 3 people. Okay. Can you just describe what you saw on the video?
Well, if you're familiar with the back of the casino, this creature is walking as you would look from the back door, from right to left, towards the dumpster. There's a fence line back there. You really couldn't make out the fence line, and it was at the edge of the parking lot. As the creature came into, and it was at night, and it was they had some kind of motion detector out there, or they had some way to illuminate it somewhat, but there's also, above the dumpster out there, there's a mercury light, and I believe that mercury light's still there. And this mercury light's probably, I don't know, 11, 12 feet tall, if I remember. I can't remember now. But this creature moved from right to left towards that mercury light and that dumpster if you were looking out the back door of the casino. And there's 2 things that really struck me about it besides the size of it. It was, I would say, a 9-10 foot, 700-800 pound animal. And this was in the dark, but it was illuminated from the mercury light. And I think some way that they illuminated with their camera. I don't know what they had as far as the surveillance system. I didn't really check it out. But the fact that they allowed us in there to see this in their security room, I thought was pretty unusual. And they replayed it for us back and forth. so that we could take a look at it. But what I said that struck me was the size of this animal, the speed that it covered the back of that parking lot. A couple, four or five strides, it was from one end of that parking lot over to where that dumpster is, and it seemed like it had to duck its head when it went underneath that mercury light. And the other thing that took me quite a while, and I'm not sure I have it straight today, was that I couldn't determine what was going on, was on the top of this animal's head, there was a kind of a green glow, almost like something you see in a night vision scope. And I couldn't figure out what that was. And so they backed it up several times, and we observed, tried to figure out and speculate what this green glow could have been. And the only thing I can say, and I, you know, generally from what I know, primates don't, their eyes don't glow. They don't have eye shine. And the only thing I can think of was that the mercury light reflected into this animal's eyes, the top of its head, and it was, the eyes were so powerful, maybe that they reflected that light back some way.
When we were there earlier this morning, where the cameras are now on the corner of the building, it's quite a distance away from where that grease trap is and where that light is. Relative to this to the screen, how big was this thing? Was it in the corner of the screen? Was it really big in the screen? Was it kind of far away?
It didn't completely fill the screen. No, it didn't fill the screen. You could see from perhaps below the knees to the top of this animal's head.
So you couldn't see the whole figure. You could only see partial.
Correct.
Now, was this shot automatically, or was there a security person viewing this at the time?
As far as I know, from what they told us, the time this camera was on all the time, it wasn't manned. It didn't follow the animal. It was just trained on the back of that parking lot, dumpster to the edge of the building. It had a wide-angle view. My understanding is they reviewed that tape, and they're in a tape loop, which a lot of security systems have, and they would normally go over and tape over it if they had no incidents. Someone within the casino security saw this and saved it, retained it. Okay. And my understanding, they even tried to put it on a hard drive, and an employee at one time was going to get it to us, and the casino authorities vetoed it.
So they did take it off of the original tape in some manner?
Yes. This was on a computer hard drive at the time, I believe.
Do you recall, was it black and white? Was it color? I mean, you said you saw a green glow. Was that green because of the, was it a monochrome image, or was it good?
It wasn't color. It was, at best, monochrome. As I said, it was in a low light situation. Okay. You couldn't make out any particular features of this animal, except it was massive, black being striding across there. You could see the arms, you could see the legs moving. You really couldn't see anything except the glow on the head. You couldn't make out any facial features. It's just a big black primate walking thing across the parking lot. It was bizarre looking, one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen.
From what I understand, they're not an open group over there. They weren't real excited about this from the standpoint of the publicity it generated. How did you manage to get yourself in there to see that video?
We impressed on them, at least I did. We would not go public with it. Initially, they were a little bit resistant, but made contact with an individual named Keith. I think he was a wildlife manager, or they took care of their animals over there, their buffalo and their cattle. And he allowed us initially to have access to the area around the casino where we could do our research at that time. The proviso was that we not go public with it. And we had some issues with that later with one of our members, but when the press showed up, I think Channel 5 or somebody showed up from Oklahoma City and said, no, we're not going to deal with this.
So was that was after you saw the video?
Yes.
Now, some people are going to say that this was some sort of publicity stunt on the part of the tribe trying to generate interest in the area. What do you think of that idea?
It's a possibility, and I can't say it was or it wasn't. I don't know for a fact. It would seem strange to me that if it's a publicity stunt, they didn't want it to become public.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of defeating the purpose, I would think.
Right. Maybe they're not very good at publicity. Where's the video now? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea. There was an individual at work that was not a member of the tribe. He was something to do with the computers, like a computer technician. and he did participate with us on an occasion or two down there at night doing some research west of the casino, and he said he would do everything in his power to get it. This went on for, I don't know, several weeks, and eventually he said, I can't get it. The powers to be within the casino are not going to release it, and the word has come out that if you discuss it anymore, employees of the casino would be terminated.
Really bad at publicity. When the figure was walking across, did it pause? Because there's a big grease trap there. This big, I don't know if it's called a grease trap, but it's a big metal dumpster that you pour grease in. Did it stop at that? Did it pause? Did it interact with that in some way?
What I saw it when it got to the grease trap, it seemed like it ducked its head there in the vicinity of the mercury light, and it looked like it leaned over the grease trap, and that's what I saw, the surveillance part of it ended. Now, the next day, or we were out there, and on a day or two after this happened, maybe or 3 days, I can't remember exactly, but apparently there was some kind of a handprint. I couldn't really determine what it was, but it looked like there's a large handprint on the side of the grease trap where something had put its hand, maybe raised it up. According to the people that worked at the casino there, that they had seen this animal before. A bus driver had seen the animal before that had brought a charter in, looking in the window of the bus, and he said it scared him enough that he went to the floor of the bus after he discharged his passengers, and the bus was parked in the back.
So he threw all the people out and then he ducked, is that what?
Well, the people had already been discharged, I guess, in front of the casino where they let them out, and sure. He parked the bus back on the back. And he was messing around or whatever, and he said this thing looked in the window at him, looked down at him in the window, and it scared him enough that he got to the floor of the bus. But some of the individuals that worked there that we interacted with and were able to talk to about it when we did come down and said they'd seen it before, and it got into the dumpster fairly routinely. And that the tribe had a restaurant, the casino had a restaurant there, and they often recycled the food, and they just threw it out there. So it was maybe a source of, food that this animal was aware of, or the other animals.
Did the film show the figure coming in from the right and going all the way out through the left? Did you see where it entered the frame and exited the frame?
The frame was set up to where it would have been at the, as you would face the west side of the back of the casino. It just appeared on the screen. Okay. And apparently that was pretty close to the edge of the casino there on the north side, on the north corner. It just appeared, strided, take us four strides across, maybe not even that many, I would say four. And it was at the dumpster, and this tape probably lasted maybe 5 or 6 seconds.
Okay, so not very long.
Not a very long tape.
How many times do you think you saw it? You said you were looping through it. How many times just roughly guesstimating, how many times do you think you actually saw this thing go back and forth?
They rewound it several times. I would say 7, 8 times, maybe 6 at the minimum, but probably no more than 8. They said, when you get tired of looking at it, we'll quit. So they were fascinated as well.
Okay, I'm sure. Any doubt in your mind as to what that was that you saw on that tape?
Probably a Sasquatch. It's either that or one hell of a big guy.
In a suit with reflective eyes.
Yeah.
What other sort of Sasquatch things have you investigated in that area, any other encounters or sightings, besides the ones that were related to this video event?
Well, we've cast tracks, a number of tracks in that area. Okay. And I've cast track. I could have cast all the tracks I wanted along that west side fence line.
Okay.
And I don't know what these were, except the thing that got my attention with the tracks was the stride. I think it was 56, 55 inches between steps, heel to toe. And they were heading north from away from the dumpster on the field side, if you will, of that fence.
What strikes me about that area is that if you showed me three pictures of countryside and said, pick the one where the Bigfoot showed up, that's not the one I would have picked because it's pretty wide open. There's not a lot of, the trees are in no way dense. I mean, there's just a couple of trees here and there. Did that surprise you, or what do you think about that when in retrospect now?
It certainly surprised me, as wide open as it is out there, and that casino sits right up on a little hill, and it's kind of like a beacon for miles around. There's nothing around there at that time. It's wide open, especially having done some research in southeast Oklahoma, which is very heavy forest, wooded area, and a little bit in northern Oregon, which is extremely wooded, as we know. It boggles my mind that these animals would be out there in that open area. The only thing that I can conclusion I can come to why they would be there is one is a ready source of food that the tribe believes in these animals, and they have from time to time put out food and have told me they've put out food for them. I had one member, I believe it was Mr. Lumpmouth, he said, we just consider them another tribe almost. And we don't want to really be around them, but we will put food out for them at certain places. The tribal members that were involved with us, assisting us in our research, they would not stay out there with us after dark. I'm not saying anything about it, but it was against their belief. There was one exception that they were out there when these things were around after this event here. But generally they would leave at last light and come back in the morning. Secondly, they told us the tribal police and the wildlife people said there are no farms to be allowed out here on this reservation. We was fine with that. We had no intention of shooting it. After they saw the video, and I believe Keith was with us, and there was a couple other people that were working for the tribe that were in that room, allowed us to get access to the security room where this tape was at, where his images were retained on a computer hard drive. They told us, they said, you know, if you want to carry a weapon, you probably should. We wouldn't be out there without a weapon after dark. And I thought that was very curious that they would say that to us.
A lot of people are going to be frustrated by the fact that there was this really compelling piece of video evidence. They knew what they had because they, at some point you got called out, so you were involved, and so they knew what you were investigating. They knew the nature of this animal and the difficulty surrounding it trying to prove its existence. The magnitude of what they had was possibly pretty significant, yet they have done something. Maybe it's destroyed, maybe it's gone forever. Why do you think that they didn't do something? They didn't capitalize on this, or at least let it be taken away for further study or something? I mean, what's driving their decision to basically just cover it up and make it go away?
Well, in my opinion, since the casino had control of that footage, or those images, if you will, I just don't think they want a bunch of people running around after weapons. And my understanding was after this event, there was some news that leaked out about it. There was even a horse shot up there from somebody driving through there with a pickup, firing a weapon from window of a pickup and shot somebody's horse.
I think a lot of people who don't have the opportunity to interact with tribes and on tribal ground don't really understand the closed nature of those societies and the value they place on their privacy. And do you sense that there's obviously a piece of that in this? At any point did you feel that they didn't want you there, they weren't cooperating, or did you feel that they were cooperating with at least you personally?
I always felt they were cooperating with us. I also felt we were privileged to be allowed access to that area, that reservation up there, because as you said, they are a closed society. And as I said earlier, they considered this just another tribe. And they didn't view the Sasquatch, they didn't consider them a threat. They just didn't want them to be bothered. They didn't want a bunch of people from the outside coming on the reservation, causing them problems. That's why I don't think it's a publicity stunt.
Did you encounter anyone out on the tribe that you can remember who doubted that these things exist, or considered this to be some kind of joke or something? Or did it appear to you that it was just an accepted part of the landscape?
I felt like it was accepted, that these things had been in our history and they had known about them, and I'd heard someone up there say it's just a white man that doesn't know about these things.
So they're not interested in proving anything, especially to us.
They're satisfied they exist.
And your profession is you're a private investigator. That's what you do.
Correct.
So you have a lot of experience questioning people and sort of judging whether or not you feel they're being truthful with you.
Yes, I have some experience in that. Yeah, I interview a lot of people. I also do criminal investigative work, too. So I've had a certain amount of experience sizing up witnesses.
And did you feel that anyone out there was being untruthful with you at any point during your investigation of this matter or any other Sasquatch-related matter?
No, I was struck by how matter-of-fact about it they were. It was just like, it's just part of it.
It's like a raccoon. It's just another thing.
Yeah, it's just another animal out here. But I was also struck they didn't really want to interact with it anymore, and they had to. They wanted to stay away from it.
Roger, I want to thank you for, I know you made quite a drive to come down here to talk to me today, so I want to thank you a lot for taking the effort and for sitting here and chatting with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, what did Roger see in that video? We'll probably never know for sure, but his impression after numerous repetitive viewings is quite clear. The scene is Alton saw it several days later, and the level of activity in the area, apparent from the reports received before and in the years after, all seem to support the notion that a large Sasquatch walked by an area where it may have found food in the past. Taken by itself, this is just a maddening might-have-been kind of event. But as you've heard, this was not an isolated encounter. A couple of days later, Alton and I had a chance to sit down and discuss further the history of the area around the reservation, the resulting investigations, and his own brief encounter with something large, dark, and hairy.
You talk to the natives that live there, and even if you go back in time through posted accounts, you'll see that for decades there have been occasional reports of Sasquatch sightings from that area. This latest round, I think, I don't know, maybe 20 years or so had passed since the last outburst of reports, if you will. Talking to some of the people that have lived there their whole life, you know, they talk about hearing stories from their older relatives that go back, you know, generations. You know, just guessing from what little information we have, it seems like that there's intermittent activity in that area. A lot of tribal-owned land that's pretty much undeveloped, and this latest round seems like it lasted a couple of years or so before it pretty much died out. There doesn't seem to be any activity in the area right now.
And what strikes me about that is there's not a lot of people living there. It looks not heavily populated at all.
No, it's pretty rural. What little towns are there, or some cases a dozen or so people may live there. They don't normally get out into the surrounding lands too much. They pretty much stick to their houses and the roads and what have you.
Following the casino security video, you had a relationship with Keith. Mm-hmm. What was Keith's role on the reservation?
He was a tribal chief. They have a number of chiefs, but he was he held that title. And his responsibilities included anything that had to do with wildlife or the tribal-owned stock. You know, they have like bison and what have you, and he was pretty much responsible for anything that had to do with animals.
And Keith took two pictures that he passed on to you. Can you describe those pictures and the scenario that led to them?
Yes, well, getting back to the video, when he first heard about the video, he went to check it out and thought to himself, well, you know, if there's video, this thing has to be around someplace. And so he started looking for sign of it, you know, tracks and that sort of thing. And over the next couple of years, he found quite a few trackways. And, you know, those of us that went to the site to investigate saw some of those and found trackways of our own. He found hares and what have you. In the process of just living there and working there, I mean, full time, he's in the field all the time. This one occasion, he was doing some cleanup after a large group activity, and he and some of his co-workers were kind of clowning around, and he took a picture of his boss and noticed something in the background and took a step or two forward to try and, you know, get a little bit of a closer look. There was kind of a wall of vegetation in front of him, and there was like a gap in the foliage, and he saw something move. He took another picture, and then when he, you know, clearly saw what it was as it walked away, it scared him. But he showed us those pictures. I'm trying to remember. It seemed like it was months after we first met him, as we developed a relationship with him and gained his confidence. He allowed me to get copies of the pictures, and I showed those pictures in 2003 at the Willow Creek International Bigfoot Symposium in California.
You've done some analysis comparing the figure that's in those pictures with the Patterson-Gimlin subject.
When I looked at the pictures, I was struck by what seemed to me to be a lot of similarities morphologically. Very tall animal, very stoutly built, long arms. And the head and shoulder combination seemed to be the same as what was shown in the Patterson-Gimlin film. We were very concerned. The first thing that we thought when we looked at it was to try and assess whether or not it could have been a costume, a person in a costume. So we made a lot of efforts to go back on site to try to replicate as closely as possible the events with subjects of known height, you know, standing in place. We knew the exact spot he had shown us, and it was very easy to see that it was the same as in his photographs. We were fortunate in that it was about 200 feet away from where he was standing, there was a small tree that had, you know, distinctive branches, and it was clear that the subject that he had photographed was standing behind this tree. We don't know how far behind it, but we put a person behind there with an object that was 7.5 feet tall. This was like our third or fourth try. It was hard to do, but we finally got as close as we could, you know, to where we were sure that our camera was at the same height as Keith's camera, you know, to try and account for parallax and those kinds of things. So it was a very tall subject. Our estimates were it was about 8 feet tall. So that compared in terms of sighting reports, you know, the Patterson-Gimlin subject, I guess, was not 8 feet tall. In other respects, it looked very similar to us, although it did not appear to be a female. It looks like it's a male. But to me, it looked very similar, yes.
My impression is that in Native American communities, they don't really feel compelled to prove the existence of this animal. They believe that this animal exists. They don't really need to prove it to us. Why do you think he worked with you in this way?
Well, that's a good question. Keith had a couple of sightings in addition to taking the photographs. We were getting a lot of reports from people that had heard of the footage, and so we were aware of what was going on. There were other entities, let's say, that were interested in trying to get involved with searching through the area and those sorts of things. I can only speculate, really. I mean, we were able to establish a friendly relationship with him, and as the months went by, I think we just developed, you know, a sense of mutual trust, and I think, you know, that was it. I mean, he didn't just pop right out the first time we showed up and say, "Hey, look at these pictures." You know, it took a long time before he, you know, mentioned them. And I think it was just that he trusted us, and he knew that, you know, we weren't going to try to exploit the situation to capitalize on it in terms of publicity or anything. You know, we'd had plenty of time to communicate to him that the last thing we wanted to do was to contact the press and inundate the tribal lands with curiosity seekers. That was one of the things that was really of concern to him, that he voiced, you know, on several occasions, that they valued their privacy and they did not want news media crawling all over the place. They didn't want a bunch of bubbas, as he described it, people with guns running all around the place trying to shoot a Sasquatch for fame and glory and money. And, you know, once he was confident of that, I think that he was willing to work with us as much as was it within his power to do. And, you know, we were thankful for that, because over the months, we were able to secure various forms of evidence, really, in terms of the existence of maybe a small group that was there. We were able to talk to a lot of people that, you know, a lot of the folks out there didn't have computers. You know, Keith didn't have a computer, for that matter. Another reason was hard to get a hold of him, because he didn't have email. You know, over time, we talked with a lot of people that, you know, it was just a really good situation to talk with people that had seen them, people that would never think about reporting anything over the internet. So we made a lot of contacts that way, found trackways, as I mentioned earlier. Keith found hares, as we did. There was one time when we went to visit, and we only had a few hours on a Sunday afternoon. Keith was real involved with coaching and that sort of thing. He said, "Well, we just have a little bit of time. We can do this, we can do that." And one of the things that he mentioned was that his boss had described seeing some tracks. And this was in an area, a densely wooded area. I wish I could have showed it to you. We didn't have time. We kind of saw the edge of it as we approached the area. Quite a few acres of really dense woods. There's like a little road that goes through it. And his boss said that he had seen what looked like tracks. The problem is this area had been closed off, because even amongst the tribe, there were a lot of people that were curious about what was going on and driving the roads, and especially at night, there were people going in there with high-beam searchlights, you know, just shining all through the woods and stuff. And so the tribe locked the gate, and at that time, we didn't have a key to the gate. We were later given a key so we could go in there and do our thing. But at that time, we didn't have a key, so he said, "If you want to look at those, you know, we'd have to climb the fence and hike in there." So that's what we ended up doing. The problem is the soil there is really, really fine, and it had rained hard the day before, and so when we got there, we didn't see any tracks. The boss had said the tracks were near this old drum. We found the drum, and right by the drum, there was a tree that was lying across the road. It had just recently fallen, and it was like at a 90-degree angle, and Keith said, "Oh, this hadn't been down before." I thought, well, you know, there's a chance, you know, that this tree just didn't happen to fall over because there hadn't been any recent strong winds or anything. So I looked on the tree and measured up about 8 feet and looked closely and found some hair. And the hair was distributed like from 8 feet to 9.5 feet. And, you know, this is part of what I described in the talk I gave at Willow Creek, but ended up pulling off, I think, 60-some hairs from there. They were most dense at the 8-foot level, and then on up the tree trunk, they were, you know, less dense. And it appeared to me like, you know, an explanation could have been that maybe an arm had been hooked around the tree and the tree had been pulled down and kind of slid up the trunk of the tree, pulling out fewer hairs as it went up. Anyway, we sent those hairs, which matched exactly hairs that Keith had found in association with trackways, sent some of the hairs to Leroy Fish, and Dr. Fish identified the hairs as primate. I'm trying to remember, Dr. Fehrenbach, I think, was basically said he wasn't sure what they were, couldn't identify them. He has a pretty good collection. You know, over the years, he's proven to be real helpful with us as far as identifying cow hair and bear hair and the sort of things that people turn into us. So, you know, that was interesting that, you know, we found hair on 3 or 4 occasions, and the hairs always matched. You know, they similar to each other, and were hairs that, you know, I ended up showing to quite a few people that I thought should be able to identify hair, and they pretty much always said, well, I don't know what it is.
There was another instance in this general area not far from the casino where there was an actual handprint that was found on the roof of a car. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was real close to the casino. That was an interesting report. I was still with the BFRO at the time, and there was an event that had happened the night before. I observed the handprint that was pretty remarkable. There was a family that lived in the little village there, and a child had been injured, and there was another baby that was crying, sympathy crying, I guess, or something. So you had two squalling kids, and a young man, I think he was 17 or 18, took one of the babies and went outside to try to comfort the child, and came face to face with a Sasquatch. The house is near pretty densely wooded areas, and as you saw, a friend of his heard about that. He submitted a real rushed report early the next morning, said that this had happened. As when he sent it in, he didn't fill out the state or anything like that. I think he mentioned the name of the village. And the way that Von Hughes set up the FLATS system.
FLATS is the database system for the BFRO tracking reports.
Yes, yes. And the report went in, but it didn't. It wasn't routed automatically to me because of being an Oklahoma investigator. Right, there was no state designated, so it just kind of went into this, you know, master list. Well, fortunately, Leroy Fish happened to be looking at the sightings the next morning, and he knew what had been going on out there and saw the name of the town, and so he shot me an email so I knew of the report. And so I called Keith just to kind of say hi and this sort of thing, just to see if he would say anything about it. Because where Keith worked, well, the office that he worked out of was real close to this house. So we chatted a bit, and then sure enough, he brought up this incident. He said that he had looked for hairs and was real disappointed. He was really into looking for hairs for us. And he just kind of in passing mentioned that that the thing had apparently walked the little garden that they had and then passed through junk vehicles. And as it had passed between these vehicles that were parked real close together, it put its hand on the roof of one of the cars. Well, that got my interest because I knew that handprints were really rare. And again, Keith really thought nothing of it. He was more upset that he couldn't find any hairs about it. So I went out there and looked at the footprints, and they were pretty much destroyed. You know, it's real common out there for people when they see the footprints or hear about them, they put their own feet in them, they put their hands in them. And so anyway, there were some very large, you know, they looked like they very well could have been Sasquatch footprints, you know, the right size and interval between the steps and those kinds of things. And they led right to this little kind of a path that went between these cars, and sure enough, there was this handprint on top of the, you know, very dusty car. And frankly, I was stunned because I was familiar with the photographs of handprints, or casts, I should say, that were in Dr. Krantz's book. And it looked just like that.
From what I've seen of these are very broad handprints with very, very fat, sort of disproportionately short fingers compared to ours.
Right, yeah, the hand had very wide fingers. They were like, I think, 4 centimeters in width. You know, when we put our hand on a chalkboard or something, we're lucky if we get, you know, I don't know, half or so of the actual width of our fingers. But these were very wide. It was a large hand. And again, it looked very similar to the cast of a hand that Grover Krantz had in his book. So
when you describe the scenario to me, and this is very close to Keith's office, it's right behind the building that office was in. The way you describe the scenario, there were 2 cars and like a riding mower. Mm-hmm. And to you, it looked as though the creature put its hand on the car as it stepped over the large platform, the deck of the riding mower.
Right, the deck of the riding mower was just, I don't know, inches or a foot or so, something like that, away from the car. And you had to step over it, basically, to go between. And the hand was positioned perfectly for, you know, imagining that something went through there. And so that's what we envisioned. I shouldn't say imagined, I guess.
Imagined would be the wrong word. You creatively reconstructed the scenario in your head.
That's it.
And then you went to pretty extreme measures to have that handprint looked at by someone who could interpret it for you.
We wanted that handprint. That's right. It was in the summertime, and, you know, rain showers come in the afternoon and these sorts of things. And I told Keith, I said, man, it'll be a lot easier for us to take this handprint with us than to try and get somebody out here to look at it. And he knew the guy that owned the car, and so we came back. Trying to remember if it was the next, it must have been the next day, I guess. Yeah, it was, because I remember I put a cover over it, found something to put on top of it just in case it rained or something to keep it, you know, protected. When we came back, that had been removed. I guess some of the tribal members had heard about it and wanted to look at it. We'd also heard that word had gotten out about it and that another group was going to come out to look at it. And so we felt the greatest sense of urgency, shall we say. And so we went back the next day and had Roger Roberts was working with Matt Moneymaker to arrange for someone to look at it. And so Jimmy Chilcutt was contacted for that. Brett Elliott and I went out, and Brett had access to the right kinds of tools. And so, you know, we took a bunch of pictures of it first, and then we cut it out of the top of the car and literally took it back with us. And we were given instructions from Roger about how to, you know, best preserve it. And so we kept it at my house until Jimmy Chilcutt, he drove actually to my house and studied it. And unfortunately, this was like August, I think. He had the worst possible combination of events, he said, for preserving handprints. We were hoping that we could get some dermal ridge impressions from it. Chilcutt said that a handprint is actually like oils from your hand that are left behind. And he was kind of funny. He was a cool guy. He said, ladies, let this be a lesson to you. He said, always keep a clean house. He said, if someone breaks into your house and you have dust all over the place, we may not be able to lift prints. But the other problem was, of course, extreme heat. And he said that the oils can disappear in extreme conditions. And this was like a black car. And so, you know, it was unfortunate, but he wasn't able to obtain any prints of any sort.
That's interesting. So a print is actually not the disturbance of the surface. It's the deposit of the oil that's left behind. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Do you still have the roof of that car in your house somewhere?
No. We had Jimmy Chilcutt take it back with him. He said that there were some other things he might be able to do. He wasn't real optimistic, but in the process of lifting the print, since it was, you know, just you know, it was basically in dust, the dust was gone, and in putting powder on it and sweeping it with his little feather sweeper or whatever it was, you know, the print itself disappeared, so there was nothing really to see. So we figured, well, might as well, you know, take it with you. And I mean, you could barely you know, see where it was, but, it, you know, it was pretty much gone, yeah.
So there's a sort of this notion in the community that it's possible these animals are in some way, I'll use the word nomadic, but they populate an area and they move on to another area. Do you think that the fact that there was activity in this area, then there wasn't for quite a while, and then there was again, and there's not again, do you think that is likely the case, or do you think that, or do you think something else?
I think that's what's happening. I really do. I think they, I guess nomadic would be the best term for it. I'm not sure what would cause them to relocate from one area to another, but it seems to me that they do set up, you know, a home area that's, you know, rather restricted for a period of time. I know that after we stopped getting reports from this area, we started getting reports from the part of the state south of there. So it made me think that it could have been the same animals and that they just relocated 100 miles south or so, and we started getting reports from that area.
These aren't seasonal, though. This happened for over several years, so this wouldn't be, it's like seasonal migration. This is more of a, they sit in a place for a while and then they move on.
That's right. Yeah, it can't be compared to migration. That's why I said perhaps, you know, nomadic is a better term. I think they respond to pressure because this area started getting some development, and some of the places that had been relatively undisturbed, the tribe went in and started cutting down trees and putting in parking lots for a events area, and there was buildings going up, and highway was widened, and the casino was expanded a little. And I don't know, there was just different things going on. They replaced fences. So there was a lot of activity going on. I just think that they felt pressured in some way and just pulled up stakes and moved out just based on increased activity.
In working with Keith over the years, he had determined that there was a pattern to their movement through that area, and you had gone out there to try to exploit the fact that you knew about that pattern, and something occurred while you were out there. Could you talk about that?
The pattern of movement thing was related to the idea that these things try to stick with cover whenever they can.
There isn't a lot of cover out there, so they don't have a lot of options.
Well, in one sense, that's true. I mean, if you just were to look out there, you'd think, man, there's no place for anything to hide. But in actuality, you know, the open prairie, it's kind of rolling, and the tall grass provides plenty of cover for a large animal even. You know, deer, there's lots of deer out there and what have you. They just lie down, and a large animal lying down in tall grass, you know, can't be seen. And there's lots of ravines and things. The casino video, when I went out to investigate that, I found the footprints that had been seen. You know, it wasn't just video of an animal that, you know, appeared out of nowhere. There were tracks also associated with that event. When I got out there, a lot of other people had been there. The tracks had already been casted, but I followed the tracks and determined that they went along the edge of the fence, and there was tall grass, tall weeds and things there. And, you know, it was easy for me to envision, you know, this thing kind of hiding behind the tall weeds perhaps. And then at the corner of this field where the tracks were, there was a tree that the fenced field used as a corner. And you could see, it looked like where something had kind of hidden under that tree, and there were broken branches there, and there were even strands of wire that were pulled out of the tree, which, you know, would have required a lot of force. And directly across this narrow road was a ravine. I mean, it was just right across the street from it. And this ravine, you know, was what I envisioned this animal had come up, you know, again to maintain cover. Well, down at the other end of the ravine was, you know, a long line of trees and cover and what have you. And Keith had told us, that he figured that the animal used that long line of trees to provide cover for it as it moved from one area of cover to another area. And up around the village, you know, we looked at the fact that there's lots of fresh water there, there's a spring there, there's lots of trees and dense cover. So we were interested in trying to, you know, maybe put a camera out to see if we could maybe capture something. In the process of doing that, we were walking along this road, and I say road, it's, you know, kind of just a little two-track path that, you know, is used maybe a couple of times a year to check on stock tanks and, you know, that sort of thing. But it was still a, you know, a path, and we were walking along it and saw a, a nice buck that was snorting at us, and then it got to be kind of a long walk. It was a lot bigger out there than, you know, you look out across an area, and then when you start walking in it, the guy I was with decided he was going to go back for his vehicle and drive it, you know, a little farther up. While he was gone, I walked away from the path to see if I could find this deer. And kind of below me was a, you know, a bit of a ravine, I guess, and there was a lot of dense vegetation along, kind of, a, you know, trees, and there was a break in the trees of a few hundred feet. As I was walking, I flushed up out of the trees a large animal. It ran away from me across the open area, you know, faster than, I mean, it was startling how quick it was, how fast it was. It ran on 2 feet. It was very large in terms of its bulk. I mean, it reminded me of like a Brahma bull or something, you know, a large black animal like that, but it was upright. And it ran across this opening into more cover. If it had run north or south, it would have been crossing, you know, many acres of just open prairie. If it had gone the other direction, it would have been coming closer towards me. From its perspective, you know, it thinks, I think that it felt like the only option that it had was to run to the nearest cover, which entailed going across this narrow opening.
You weren't walking towards the tree that it was hiding in.
I was sort of angling towards it, yeah.
So if any animal was observing you, it probably would have sort of weighed the options and decided to be further away would be better than sitting there with the potential of you walking right up on top of it.
Yeah, the impression that I had was that it thought that I'd seen it and that I was approaching it. And it just flushed and ran away. And a few seconds, you know, 2 or 3 seconds, it seemed that short. You know, when I went back later and measured the distance, you know, I was very surprised at how far it actually was. It covered hundreds of feet in just very, very short period of time, literally seconds.
And it was black?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was black.
Could you make out any shape to the body? Could you see arms or a head or anything like that?
Yeah, it had very, very broad shoulders. The arms, it ran in an odd way. It ran kind of hunched over. It immediately reminded me of film or video that I've seen of people that are being shot at, the way they run, like police officers or people that are, you know, Marines or soldiers, when they're running, the way they kind of hunch over to present less of a target. I mean, that's what it looked like, you know, kind of hunched over as it ran.
And it was running through grass, so in this case it could have hunched over to keep itself a little more hard to see.
No, it was much taller than the grass. I mean, the grass was high. I couldn't really see below its knees. The grass was, I don't know, 3 feet tall or so. And that's kind of what helped me gauge its height. I mean, it looked very, very large. I estimated, and I know this is a popular, you know, estimate that people say, but, you know, it literally seemed like it was at least 8 feet in height. All I could see was the back of its head. It did not have a, you know, like a human-like neck that could be seen.
Maybe you said this already, but maybe I didn't hear you. How close do you think it was to you? Could you make out any detail, any musculature or anything like that in the figure as it moved?
Not specifically. I mean, all I could tell was black, and I mean, it was, you could definitely tell that, you know, it had musculature and, you know, limbs and that sort of thing, but I can't say that I observed its trapezius or anything like that. I mean, you could just see that it was a very substantial, you know, like I say, it reminded me of a Brahma bull, you know, in terms of the general appearances as saying, you know, this is a muscular animal.
Your reaction to that, as it happened and immediately afterward, can you describe, like, what went through your mind? What were you thinking? I don't think you had a camera with you, but if you had a camera, would you have had the presence of mind to raise it?
No. I wasn't frightened. I was just shocked.
Yeah.
And
it was over so quickly.
Yeah. And the literally, as I'm standing there after it had happened, I was just thinking, like, I kind of go through a list, you know, crow. I mean, things that are black. I mean, that's the first thing I thought of, you know, things that are black. I mean, even though it was huge, it sounds crazy, but, you know, I'm thinking crow, no. You know, cow, no. You know, I had a very short list of possibilities of big
Kodiak bear, no.
Big black things that, you know, run upright. But that's what happened. You know, I just stood there literally running through a list of possible things. I mean, that's what I did. You know, I can't explain any logic behind it. That's what I did.
Did you consider going after it?
No. You know, again, in retrospect, you know, you think, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? But, you know, I was just kind of in a state of I don't guess shock is quite the right word, but I was just stunned.
Yeah.
And didn't chase after it. I mean, we were there to put out a camera trap, and that's what we ended up doing.
Okay. And nothing showed up in the camera trap, obviously.
No. No, we put it on a tree and secured it tightly with a bunch of bungee cords. It had like flanges that came out from its case and little holes in it. And when we went back, it was on a pretty steep slope, a little drainage coming down from an area, a ceremonial grounds area that's, you know, was farther to the south. But when we went back, the camera was off the tree and it was uphill and behind the tree, which I found very odd. But that particular camera, the batteries did not last very long at all in it, and they were dead and there were no pictures on it. But something had messed around with it and somehow had taken it off the tree.
You never reported that event of the figure running away from you like that. Why didn't you report that?
I didn't submit a report, you know, like a published sighting report. No. I told a few of the curators what I'd seen. Kathy Moskowitz, Kathy Strain now, Teo Stein, a few people I told, but it was just a sighting. You know, we had thousands of sightings. We had many reports of sightings from that area. You know, my interest is in obtaining evidence, and a sighting, you know, an antidote is not going to really contribute much towards that end. You know, I just didn't feel like that it was something I needed to do or wanted to do. For one thing, I didn't really. At that point, I tried to stay as behind the scenes as possible. You know, I was working to address with Dr. Fish and others collecting evidence, and you know that was my primary concern and pursuit, and it remains that with the TBRC. We're trying to get photographic evidence, other forms of evidence, and you know, sightings, you know, might be titillating or interesting or whatever, but I just didn't feel like that it would add anything.
What is the value of sightings at this point? We have, as you pointed out, well, if you go to the BFRO website, there's thousands of sightings on there. If you look in the literature, there's sightings going back for hundreds and hundreds of years into Native American culture. Very, very seldom is anything reported that we haven't seen before. I think that's a true statement. So what is the value of still collecting sightings? Why should an organization bother with that at this point?
Well, they do help set up trends, as you say, but that's something that I think, you know, we pretty much, I think, have in hand is the idea of the correlations between, you know, like rainfall and habitat and distribution of sightings. And, you know, we've learned a lot through the patterns of sightings. Pete and Yellow has looked at changes over time, and it's correlated them with some interesting human development kinds of things. So that's, I think, of value and shows, or at least indicates, the presence of a population of animals versus just random sightings. You know, we can see changes over time. But I think the primary value of them really is in terms of recent sightings. For example, in the TBRC, in Louisiana, we had a situation where this family reported sightings and activity, and I'm not real familiar with the report. You know, the Louisiana people were, you know, or are investigating this, but I think they had like a broken fence or something, and they found hares. And so our guys went over there and observed the hares, collected them, and sent them to Henner Fehrenbach, and one of the hares matched the hares that he has that, you know, have these distinctive characteristics. And that was the first hare that he was aware of, or that any of us are aware of, from Louisiana. So I think recent sightings, you know, are of particular value in terms of trying to do an immediate follow-up.
I would say many of the critics of this entire train of thought that we're following here would say that sightings are of limited value because people have fallible memories. They can embellish and even if not purposely doing that. But I think what I hear you saying is that there's value in being able to establish the trends of movement of these things and getting out there quickly enough to do some sort of on-scene investigation to find something that's a little more concrete.
Yeah. Well, those are two different things, you know, that would be of interest to a biologist, you know, looking at changes over time of a population or the distribution and abundance of a population. You know, those are the real fundamental questions that interest biologists. But, of course, in terms of documentation, you know, that's the other half of it, and the recent sightings come into play there.
Our conversation begins to wind down, and even though the others in our group are patiently waiting for Out in the Night to finish, it's clear everyone wants to get moving. It's a long drive back into Dallas. As a matter of fact, I'm getting to realize that all the drives in Texas are long. But this gives me ample opportunity to consider how this group of dedicated Sasquatch investigators, along with a small, rural, and reclusive community, and seemingly at least one prairie Bigfoot, have all come together to tell a fascinating tale. When I started this program, I called this a remarkable series of events, and it surely is. I wonder now how many other places in North America there are where similar events have transpired, and I wonder if it hadn't been for the persistent work of Alton and Roger and their associates, if you or I or anyone would know that in this place, these things happened. I want to thank Alton Higgins, Roger Roberts, and all the others whose assistance and hospitality were essential in making this podcast a reality. If you'd like to discuss what you've heard here or discuss any other Sasquatch-related topic, please visit the Bigfoot Forums at bigfootforums.com. Bibcast 5 is next on my agenda. In that one, I'll tell the story of the second half of my trip in the TBRC territory. You'll hear me slog through the swampy, sticky, smelly, spider-infested woodlands of the Big Thicket. Look for that one sometime in late summer. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet when the wind comes right behind the rain. Oklahoma, every night my honey lamb and I sit alone and talk and watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky. We know we belong to the land.